I've read a lot of books about leadership in my life, and I've probably read about 100 books or so on the subject of leadership. And I can say that and it not be a brag, because I have no idea whether it's actually made me a better leader. That is not something for me to decide. I think I'm just drawn to the genre. I like those kind of books, and I like to learn from them. And I've been blessed by a lot of great leaders in my life, and it's made me want to be the best leader that I can be. So I read a lot of books. Some are from the business world, some are from the church world, some are biographies of great leaders, and some are biographies of horrible leaders who have led over the years. Not all of the books are good, but I've been reading books on leadership for about 25 years, listened to a lot of podcasts and tapes. And what I want to do this morning, I want to share the leadership lesson that has most stuck with me for all that time. So in general, most of us could plot out our working relationships on a compass, north, south, east, and west. Most of us have superiors that we report to. We have bosses, we have directors, we have supervisors. And that's north on the compass. And we have to lead up to those people. We have to show that our work fits the direction that they have given us to take. Most of us work with colleagues, and those would be represented by east and west on the compass. These are people that we have to work with in order to accomplish things, but we don't necessarily have any authority over them whatsoever. They may choose to help us and work with us, but they may choose to be obstacles in us getting things done. We have to get stuff done with them, but we don't exactly manage them by the basis of authority. And then some of us have direct reports. There are people that we directly manage. We are paid in some sense to work with them, to develop them, and they report to us. And you can map this out on something of a family. You know, within your family, there are some analogs for this. But I want us to keep this compass in mind as we talk about an episode in David's life. So if you have a Bible, turn to 1 Samuel chapter 30. 1 Samuel chapter 30. It says, "Now when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, the Amalekites made a raid against the Negeb and against Ziklag. They had overcome Ziklag and burned it with fire and taken captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. They killed no one, but carried them off and went their way. And when David and his men came to the city, they found it burned with fire, and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep. David's two wives also had been taken, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters." This is a bad day at the office for David. They go out on a raid and they come back and they find the city is burned with fire and their wives and their children are taken. They have no idea where they've gone. They have no idea how to get them back. David's own wives and kids are gone. He is grieved in his soul. But then it gets worse for David because his own men talk about stoning him. They're so upset, they're so angry that they talk about stoning him. It's not really clear what that would actually accomplish. They would be taking out the best leader among them, but they are so distraught that it's the best thing that they can think of to do. They're so angry they want to take it out on the leader. This surely must be his fault. David could be a handy scapegoat. So I want you to imagine that you're David, and you see the city burned with fire, and your wives and your kids are taken, and so is everybody else's, and the men are talking about stoning you. Imagine that you're David. There's no one above you on the compass. There's no general that you report to. You're the top dog. There's nobody to the left or right. You don't really have any colleagues who are coming to your aid. And there's no one down below you who doesn't want to stone you at this moment. So what do? Do you make a speech to try to talk down the men? Do you kind of amp up and assert your authority? Hey, I'm David. Do you know who I am? How can you be talking about stoning me? Do you start to jump into strategy and tactics about how to go after the wives and children and get them back? Or do you quit and just say, you ungrateful lot, you have no gratitude, I'm out of here, I'm going to go search for my wives and kids on my own? Well, interestingly, David does none of these things. And I deliberately left off the last little bit of verse 6. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. As the men are talking about stoning him, it says, David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. No speech, no strategy, no convening a council, no tactics. In order to address the terrible crisis that's on his hand, David had to get himself right. He had to get himself right before he could do anything else. He had to bring his absolute best to the situation, and the way to do that was to strengthen himself in the Lord his God. He had to know his God down to the core of who he was before he could re-engage with his men. If he had tried to manage the men, if he had tried to assert his authority, if he had tried to immediately jump into strategy, that might have been the end of David. His men might have mutinied, risen up, and killed him. It might have been the end. But David turned to the one who knew him, who cared about him, who had preserved his life thus far, who loved him, and the one who could help him. David turned to the one who could actually help him. And he strengthened himself in that assurance that God was with him. And it changed everything. Because I'm not going to read the rest of the story, but from there they are able to go on and defeat the Amalekites and get their wives and children back. So it changes everything. He doesn't try to manage his men, and he doesn't try to manage the situation. David starts by managing himself. And he does that by strengthening himself in the Lord his God. So here's the lesson that stayed with me for all these years. The first and most important person that you need to manage is yourself. The first and most important person that you need to manage is yourself. This is the art of self-management. Whether you're a husband leading your wife, or you're a father leading your family, whether you're a boss leading direct reports, whether you're a colleague managing lateral relationships, whether you're a home group leader leading a home group, or whether you're a kid and you have siblings and you have friends, whoever you are, you can't relate well to anybody if you are not managing yourself first. Managing your emotions, your trust in God, your anxiety, your convictions, your integrity, your vision, your character, your words, and your worst tendencies. Managing all those things before you then try to manage other people. Does this make sense so far? Does this begin to land with everybody? Or at least what the concept is. I'm going to flesh it out a little bit more. But how you're doing inside is what you bring to every encounter. Wherever you go, you always take yourself. And how you're doing inside is what you take to every encounter. If you're not doing well, you bring that to all your relationships. You've probably never heard of a guy named D-Hawk. Has anybody ever heard of D-Hawk? You may not have ever heard of him, but he was the founder of the Visa company, the credit card company. He was responsible for Visa coming into existence. He was wildly successful, obviously, in his job, and he retired at age 55. And when he retired, he went into relative seclusion on a 200-acre ranch where he could study and give himself to contemplation and manage a couple of cattle. That's all he wanted to do after he retired. wanted to go off the grid. He wanted to manage some cattle and study and contemplate. He tells a story that he believes communicates the essence of leadership, and it kind of feeds into what I've been talking about so far. So I'm going to read an excerpt from this essay that he wrote in 2000. He talks about, let's see, I'm going to figure out where I want to start here. Okay, so he's on his ranch. He says, I was attending to chores in the barn, comfortable and secure from the wind howling about the eaves and the roar of torrential rain on the tin roof. Through the din, I became aware of a faint, persistent bellowing of one of the cows. Awareness gradually rose that this bellowing was unusual. Flashlight in hand, I plunged into the storm and worked my way across the pasture in the direction of the sound. On the far side, in the circle of light from the flash, I could make out Eunice, the huge one-horned mother cow. Sheltered in the corral to await the imminent birth of her calf, she had somehow gotten out and sought a private place to give birth. Unfortunately, on the brink of a steep bank 15 feet above a flooded creek which raged through a ravine choked with poison oak and wild blackberry vines. I raced to the spot and saw from the trampled ground and smashed bushes what had happened. She had given birth. The calf, struggling to gain its feet, had slipped over the edge and plunged into the bank, into the creek, then desperately tried to climb the sheer bank to get free of the water. Eunice had done all she could, racing up and down the bank, bellowing and searching in vain for a way down. By the time I responded to her cries, the calf had been swept downstream beneath tangled vines and brambles. Grabbing at limbs and bushes, I half fell, half stumbled down the sheer bank into the creek. Pushed by the rushing icy water, I worked my way under and through the thickets and brambles. In a bend of the creek, 100 feet downstream, I spotted the exhausted calf fighting to keep its head above water. By the time I arrived, it had given up and was submerged. I pulled it onto a shelf of rocks beneath the mass of tangled growth and began pumping its ribs, trying to eject water and assist its breathing. It was a magnificent dark red bull calf, the hair on its flank a mass of curls, its soft hooves torn and bleeding from efforts to climb the bank. It revived a little and began to kick and struggle. Pocketing the flashlight, I managed to heave it across my shoulders and begin a struggle upstream to the place where I had entered and might have a chance to climb out. A frantic 30 minutes after shouldering the calf, I arrived, shaking, bruised and bleeding from cuts and scratches at the bottom of the cut bank where the calf had tumbled in. Legs braced against the force of the rushing water, I paused to recover breath and strength before trying to clamber up. Suddenly, over the sound of pulse pounding in my ears, the rushing water, the shrieking wind, and pelting rain, from directly overhead came a furious, heart-stopping roar. In stark terror, I let go of the calf's front legs and fumbled for the flashlight. Another earth-shaking roar, and then another. The light came on as I swung the beam in the direction of the sound. Exhausted, thigh-deep in swirling, icy water, with 60 pounds of kicking calf draped around its neck, around my neck, I stared straight in pure panic directly up into the blood-red eyes of 3/4 of a ton of frantic mother cow, convinced I was butchering her baby, and a ton of enraged bull determined to save his family. In that brief instant, eye to eye with nearly 2 tons of bovine fury, the essence of management was simple and clear. First, manage myself and get mind, body, and emotions under control before they ceased to exist. Second, manage 2 tons of enraged bovine superiors who most certainly had power over me. Third, manage my environment and find a way out of the ravine. Fourth, and by far the least important, manage my only subordinate, the kicking calf. And oh, how I wish the calf knew the theory and managed himself. his superiors and his environment, and not put the whole outfit into such an unholy mess in the first place. So just like David, before Ha could do anything relative to the angry animals above him or the raging environment around him, he had to get himself right. He had to manage his own mind and body and emotions before he could be effective in any other space. So does this concept make sense? Does it make sense? Before you try to manage anybody else, up, down, laterally, you first have to manage yourself. Jesus was always on his game, everywhere he went. And it wasn't because he was God in the flesh. He was full in his full humanity. He was at his best on every occasion. And the elders and the scribes intentionally tried to trip him up time and time again, and they failed. He was fully in charge of himself. There were no renegade emotions or outbursts or actions. Everything Jesus did was by pure intention. And when we look at some ways of how Jesus organized his life, we see how he was able to do this. So Mark 1:35, "And rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed." Or Luke 6:12, "In these days he went out to a mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God." Jesus' communion with his Father strengthened him for every occasion. He strengthened himself in the presence of his Father. And that communion is available to all of us. That communion is available to us. I read this a couple of years ago when we were talking about the cardinal virtues. But it's what William Penn wrote about George Fox, who is the founder of the Society of Friends Church, better known as the Quakers. William Penn wrote this about George Fox. "So meek, contented, modest, easy, steady, tender, it was a pleasure to be in his company. He exercised no authority but over evil, and that everywhere and in all, with love, compassion, and long-suffering. A most merciful man, as ready to forgive as unapt to take or give offense. I write by knowledge and not by report, and my witness is true, having been with him for weeks and months together on diverse occasions, and those of the nearest and most exercising nature, and that by night and by day, by sea and by land, in this and in foreign countries, and I can never say that I saw him out of place and not a match for every service or occasion." Deep down, I think we all want to be like that. I think we all want to be a match for every service and occasion. We want to be men who, when everybody else is losing their heads, we still keep our heads on. And we can be a plus in every situation that we're in. Not because we're self-made men, not because we're independent men, but because we know our God. And because we walk with God. Men who can move through the world with the mindset of Paul in Philippians 4. "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." I've said that this leadership lesson has stuck with me through life. It's also the one I found most difficult to actually live. It's the one that I find time and time again I keep coming back to because I keep seeing my own failure in living out the lesson. Because it is way easier to manage situations and other people than to manage myself. Because I may suspect where I'm off, and I may suspect where things are not quite right in me, but I know what's wrong with you. And it's a lot easier for me to just come to you and say what's wrong with you than to actually do the work of managing myself. I remember what it's like to be a young dad and to be a dad with young kids. And it's much easier to focus on what to do with this crying baby during church, you know, and to think about, okay, well, what are the people thinking? Is this too loud or what do I do? And all that noise going on in my head, rather than not reacting, making sure that I'm secure in God, and really thinking through what is best for the situation instead of just reacting to my own internal panic. If you are a young dad and you're there, I've been there. I understand. Philippians 4, 6 through 8 is probably not my favorite verse in the Bible, but it is the one that is most important to me. It's the one that I continually return to when I think about being strengthened in God and managing myself. So Philippians 4, 6 through 8, Paul says, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things." I think if we were to ask Paul for his pastoral guidance on today's mental health crisis, whether you believe there's a crisis or not, but if we were to ask Paul for his pastoral guidance on mental health, I think he would say Philippians 4, 6 through 8. I think that's what he would give us from his pastor's heart. And it boils down to three things. Give all your cares and anxieties to God. Receive his peace. And give your attention to what actually deserves it. Give all your cares and anxieties to God. Receive his peace. And give your attention to what actually deserves it. So much of managing ourselves comes out of this. And so I'm going to go through each of those three. So the first one, give all your cares and anxieties to God. Every one of them. There is nothing that is too small for God. We may think it's really small and really petty, but God does not. Paul says, give all our anxieties and cares. He is the creator of heaven and earth. There is no one better positioned to work in your favor than God himself. And Paul says that the way from getting bogged down in a swamp of anxieties and cares is to give them to God one after another as soon as they surface. As soon as that anxiety starts to come in, as soon as that care is developing, give it to God one after the other as a reflex. We know the lyrics from the song, "Great is Thy Faithfulness." Strength for today and bright hope for tomorrow. In giving our cares and anxieties to God, we have strength for today and hope for bright hope for tomorrow. Steve Cuss, who wrote the book, The Expectation Gap, Chad wrote a review on it this week and sent it out. He also did the retreat for our ordained leaders a couple of months ago. He uses a phrase. He says he tends to worry his way to peace. And I don't know, maybe that resonates with you. Do you ever try to worry your way to peace where you've got this big boulder-like worry or concern, and you worry about it, trying to get it down, whittle it down to something that's manageable? Well, okay, at least I can manage it this way, because you've worried away various angles. So he tends to worry his way to peace, and I can tend to do the same. But Paul and Jesus point to us giving all of our cares and anxieties to God. It's an essential part of managing ourselves, to know that the best thing that I can do when a worry comes into my life, when there's a stressful situation, when there's a point of tension, is to immediately give it to God with gratitude and thanksgiving that he is a God who loves us and cares for us, and he is in position to help. Does that make sense? Is that good?
Yeah.
One after another as a reflex. And we can't be strengthened by God if we don't have convictions about who God is and what he is like. So we have to know our God. We have to be studied in the scriptures of what our God is like, so that we're not dragging in these images of God that are not biblical. Because sometimes I think we can kind of think of God as like the Greeks thought of their gods, kind of just willy-nilly dealing with human beings and maybe favoring one and not favoring another. That's not in the Bible. That is not a scriptural view of God. So to know God, we have to know what God is like. And the scriptures give us that. We have to know that we are not orphans. God has not created us and just wound up the clock and then departed. We are not orphans. God loves us perfectly. He cares for us perfectly. He provides for us perfectly. He protects us perfectly. Even if we see it all through imperfect eyes. Paul says in Romans 8, if God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? So we have to give our cares and anxieties to God. That's the first part of Philippians 4, 6 through 8. The second is to receive the peace of God. Paul says the peace of God surpasses all understanding. It doesn't register cognitively in ways that other things do. It surpasses all understanding and it guards our hearts and our minds in Christ Jesus. We may not know exactly how things are going to work out. So we reflexively give our cares and anxieties to God. That doesn't mean we're instantly given the solution to everything. It doesn't mean we automatically know what's going to happen. We don't know how things are going to work out, but God gives us the peace that keeps us from going off the rails. God gives us the peace that keeps us from fruitless speculation about what might happen and what might not. We have the peace that keeps us from doing self-destructive things out of our own reactivity. And this isn't a one-time thing. Just as we constantly give our cares and anxieties to God, we constantly have to receive the peace of God. And I may have a sense of overwhelming peace that I may not know how this is going to work out, but that I trust that God is with me. And I may have peace in that. And then a half an hour later, anxiety comes right back. And I have to do it again. And I have to do it again in another hour. And I have to do it again after that. It's not a one-time thing. It's a constant relationship with God of giving those cares and anxieties and receiving his peace. And that's part of doing the work of managing ourselves, is being in that motion constantly. Proverbs 24:16 says, the righteous falls seven times and rises again. But the wicked stumble in times of calamity. When calamity comes, the wicked stumble. They may not even fall right away, but they stumble. The righteous man falls seven times and gets back up again because he knows his God. This is a parenthetical anecdote, but I was driving to Ohio last week and I was, I don't exactly remember the city, but it's where they have the big flea market and they have the giant statue of Jesus coming out of the pond. And it had a sign and it said, fall seven times, rise eight. And I was like, oh, that's good. I might want to use that in men's meeting teaching next week. I don't remember the verse. And so I went and looked for it. And it turns out it's a Japanese proverb. It's not even in the Bible. Not even in the Bible. They had it on their church sign. But Proverbs 24 does say the righteous falls seven times and rises again. So anyway, we receive the peace of God over and over again because he gives it abundantly. Number three, give your attention to what actually deserves it. So often we become distressed because we've paid attention to this financial news report or this social media post or this rumor about what somebody thinks. And it's all manufactured anxiety. Hardly any of it may have a basis in reality. It's about things that might happen and things that might not happen. But still, they can infiltrate our minds and get in our hearts. And we all of a sudden become very anxious about those things. But in Philippians 4:8, Paul gives us so many directions about where we could put our attention. And they all reinforce the goodness of God, and he strengthens us through those channels. We can focus on what's wrong, what's bad, what's troubling. And we can't just float on air and pretend that those things aren't out there or don't touch us. But even when attending to things that are wrong, even when attending to real problems in our lives, in ourselves, in our relationships, in our world, even when giving attention to those things, we can still look for what's true, what's honorable, what's just, what's praiseworthy, what's pure, what's excellent, even within those things. Because nothing is really entirely bad. There are still some good things that can come out of those things. And we can attend to those. There's a principle in physics, not that I'm a physicist, this is secondhand knowledge, called self-organizing criticality. You don't need to know the term, but here's what the term means. Here's the idea. When a structure is hit by an object from the outside, the extent of the damage to the structure will depend on how the structure was organized prior to impact. So if the structure was shaky in the first place, if the foundation was bad, if the wood is bad, if other things are wrong, and the impact comes, it's going to do more damage than if it was a very solid structure. And maybe even a larger impact might not have as much damage to a structure that's well-formed. Does that make sense? If a church is strong in the Lord, if we are strengthened by our God and strengthened by our bonds to one another, Jesus says the gates of hell cannot prevail against it. The very gates of hell cannot prevail against a church like that, that knows its God and is strengthened in its bonds with one another. And to the degree that we are organized by being strengthened by our God, we can endure a lot. We can endure a lot. We can receive a lot of impact from the outside. We can receive a lot of blows from the enemy and remain standing. Paul says in Ephesians 6, after doing all, to stand. And we can remain standing if we are strengthened by our God. And as fathers, as husbands, we can strengthen our families. We can set the tone for our families so that when trouble comes from the outside, when bad things happen, we can remain strong in our families. And I want to close with an excerpt from an anecdote. This is from a book by Stephen Covey. And yes, I know he was a Mormon, but I do think Stephen Covey had a lot of good things to say. So he's talking about a man who had just a growing sense that he wanted to lead his family, and he gave a lot of thought to how he wanted to be remembered by his kids and the kind of impact that he wanted to have upon his kids. And they were getting ready to take a vacation as a family. And he says, when we planned our vacation, we came up with a sort of family mission statement for the event. We called it the Smith Team. It described for us the perspective we wanted to take when we went off together on our trip. We also had matching t-shirts. And at one point, we went into a service station, and the attendant wasn't paying much attention. But when he looked up, and we were all standing there with our matching shirts, he did a double take and said, "Hey, you guys look like a team." And that just cemented it for us. We all looked at each other and felt an incredible high. We got back in the car and took off, windows down, radio cranked up, ice cream melting in the back seat. We had a sense that we were a family. About 3 months later, after we got back from our vacation, our three-year-old son was diagnosed with leukemia. This threw our family into months of challenge. The interesting thing to us was that whenever we took our son to the hospital for chemotherapy treatments, he would always ask if he could wear a shirt. Maybe it was his way of connecting back to the team and feeling the support and the memories he had around the experiences of being together on that family vacation. After the sixth treatment, he caught a serious infection that put him in intensive care for 2 weeks. We came very close to losing him, but he pulled through. He wore that t-shirt almost nonstop through those days, and it was covered with stains of vomit, blood, and tears. When he did finally pull through and we brought him home, we all wore our family t-shirts in his honor. That vision of the Smith Team helped us through what was the greatest challenge our family had ever faced. That's a family that was organized in a way prior that when cancer came, they were able to pull together and get through it together. We can be men who know our God, who depend upon Him and not ourselves, who manage ourselves to live under the shadow of His wings. And all the relationships that we touch, north, south, east, and west, will benefit because of it. Amen?